Running the world's largest art museum requires a well-orchestrated effort to keep everything shipshape. Coming up today on Travel with Rick Steves, Elaine Sciolino takes us behind the scenes at the Louvre in Paris. She tells us what goes on when the museum is closed to the public on Tuesdays.
You've got to worry about the moths and the tapestries.
Richard Rhodes had the rare privilege of being the last apprentice and the only non-Italian in over 700 years to be trained by the Freemasons Guild in Tuscany. They taught him the closely guarded, sacred rules of medieval stonemasonry.
As a material, it's capable of so much visual expression.
Richard helps us see how rock, fashioned into stonework and art, is core to our humanity through the ages.
It wears and weathers and becomes something better through its interaction with man.
Take a peek inside the Louvre on its day off and get a feel for the art of stone. It's just ahead on today's Travel with Rick Steves. It's been said that there are occasions when even the stones can cry out. If you've ever had the chance to walk on a 2,000-year-old Roman road, you've felt the graciously weathered stones beneath your feet. Or if you've ever stood in awe in front of an Egyptian pyramid or Inca temple, or even when you admire the work of a craftsman or artist closer from home, you'll know that great stonework can sometimes seem to have a pulse. Richard Rhodes was the last apprentice to be trained by the Stoneworkers Guild of Tuscany. They taught him the techniques mastered by medieval cathedral builders and Renaissance artists, the people whose masterpieces are often highlights of our travels today. Richard joins us in a bit to help us look at stonework in a whole new light. Let's start today's Travel with Rick Steves with Paris-based journalist Elaine Sciolino. She's been with us many times on Travel with Rick Steves to share what she's observed about French society from her longtime vantage point in Paris. Among her many titles, her latest book centers on the Louvre Museum. Its enormous collection of art and artifacts can be overwhelming if entered without a plan. And if your plans take you there on a Tuesday, you'll be disappointed, because that's the one day of the week the museum is closed to the public. Not counting unplanned closures for staff strikes or investigating a bold jewelry heist, Tuesdays are the one day when the Louvre takes care of things behind the scenes. Elaine investigated why for her book, Adventures in the Louvre.
Yes, the museum is closed every Tuesday.
And you can kind of tell from the tone of my voice that it's been frustrating over the years. But then when I got into filming for a TV show, I realized that for, $400 an hour, you can actually go to the museum on a Tuesday when it's closed and you can do your filming. Or if you're a fancy rock star, you can take your entourage
through. If you paid only $400 an hour, you got a deal. And Beyonce, who went in there, I think paid a lot more she rented the Louvre for a night. Yes. So you shouldn't probably tell too many people, Rick, that you only paid $400, because a lot of people will pay $400 to get into the Louvre on a Tuesday.
Sure. And when you go to the museum any other day and it functions and it works, well, it functions and it works because they can get it all organized and patched up and prepared on that precious one day a week when the workers can come out, the big shots with their entourages can get that private tour, but the masses of the people have to wait until Wednesday. So, Elaine, you've done a lot of thinking about the Louvre to write your book, and you were impressed by all the people who work there, and you were impressed by all the work that goes on a Tuesday. First of all, tell us, what happens on a Tuesday?
Well, first I have to tell you that I went into the Louvre like a street reporter. I didn't go in as an art historian. I didn't go in as a tour guide. So I said, okay, this is a world I have to master by talking to people. So I wanted to ask questions, you know, how do you clean the pyramid? And that is really interesting. You've got to have a whole team of window washers on the inside and the outside of the pyramid with special kind of motorized suction-cupped vehicles in order to clean the darn thing.
And we should mention that's the glass pyramid entryway in the middle of the courtyard designed by I.M. Pei, new part of the Louvre, yeah.
Okay, and one of the dirty little secrets is that the pyramid leaks, as does much of the Louvre. Much of the Louvre it's leaky like a sieve. You've got to patch these roofs. You've got to make sure that the paintings are not affected by water that's dripping down the walls, which in the past they have had to have emergency evacuations of paintings. you've got to worry about the moths and the tapestries. I mean, I went out with a woman who had to set the traps to get the moths so that they didn't eat all the tapestries. Mm. All this has to be done on a Tuesday. Cleaning the Louvre, keeping it dust-free, has to be done on a Tuesday.
And you wrote that the Louvre has 500,000 works of art, but they can't hang all of those at the same time. There's 400 rooms, but that doesn't contain 500,000 works, so they swap in and out as at the whims of the curator. And that has to be done, of course, not when people are there, but on Tuesdays.
Of course, it has to be done on Tuesdays. They have to water the plants on a Tuesday. I mean, everything that behind the scenes has to be done on a Tuesday. Also, you know, you've got union workers and they've got rights and you've got to have a day off. So right. That if you're going to have to work Saturday or Sunday, you get Tuesday off.
Elaine Chelino is our guest from Paris right now as we look at Tuesdays at the Louvre, the one day of the week that you cannot get in. Elaine's been awarded by the French government for her work as a journalist, writing for the New York Times, and her books that help explain French society to the rest of the world. She's just written Adventures in the Louvre, How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum. Her website is elainechelino.com, spelled S-C-I-O-L-I-N-O. You know, I mentioned the word curator, and all over Europe when I'm updating my guidebooks, I can be frustrated because I've described a museum or a gallery perfectly, and then a year later there's a new curator and everything is rearranged. What's your take on curators and how do they matter for the museums?
Well, the Louvre is a very classic, conservative place. You know, don't forget the Louvre is an institution of the French state. It's run by the culture ministry and ultimately the president. It's the president of the republic who determines who is going to be the director of the Louvre so that you don't have the changes and the transformation that you've got in a lot of other kinds of more modern museums. The Louvre is sort of old-fashioned. You're going to find most of the works of art still there.
Still, the curator has a personality. And a lot of times when there's a new curator, at least in other museums, you find that they can rearrange things. You're right. The Louvre is one of the most stable museums, I think, in all of Europe because of that conservative bent that you described. But still, the curator does have to make decisions about what do we buy, what do we show. A lot of people forget that a museum is not for tourists who come in once in their lifetime, but it's also for the local public that come in many, many times throughout their lifetime. And if they didn't have new things, people wouldn't want to come back.
Well, you know, I would say, Rick, that the Louvre might be different from most other museums because decisions are made by committee. Ah. You know, a curator has very little power individually. Everything has to go through a department and then the hierarchy of the Louvre and then the Ministry of Culture. You can't just decide to put a new feather on the Victory of Samothrace, which happened several years ago when she was being restored, without an international committee of experts coming in and telling the curator, this is what we think should be done.
Wow.
This is one reason why the Louvre is so slow to change. I kind of compare it to a great aircraft carrier that you have to turn around very, very slowly.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Elaine Chelino. Her book is Adventures in the Louvre, How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum. Let's just take one walk through the museum on a Tuesday. When I'm there on a Tuesday, for my budget price of $400 an hour, we are busy with an escort for security. They don't want people roaming around without an escort on Tuesday. We have a list of paintings that we want to film, and we have so much time that we have overall. And we have our way with these museums, and they control how much light we shine on the art and so on, but we get to do some very exciting work. At the same time, we've got people carrying paintings here and there, in and out for restoration or whatever. We've got big shots with their entourage. Tell us a little bit about what's going on with that.
Well, I have to first say that you say you were led around by people who told you what you couldn't do, which is part of the Louvre mentality with visitors. And what they did to you on a grand scale, they did with me on a small scale, that in the beginning, when I started this project, I was assigned a minder. There was a confidential document that was circulated around the Louvre that said, this book could be a risk for us, and she is not to talk to anybody at the Louvre unless she is with this one designated person. So I was forbidden from having normal conversations from people who worked at the Louvre. You know, I did make friends with a couple of people who I would sort of have over for lunch, and it was kind of like having a secret affair because I was playing.
I didn't know they were so careful that way. Disneyland's that way also.
Oh, it was just extraordinary. And and it's part of the Louvre culture, which is closed and old-fashioned. Yes.
Fascinating.
Would you allow me to share one of my little secrets about what to do on a Tuesday when you arrive with your family at the gate of the Louvre and they tell you that it's closed and you're ready to, like, kill the security guard or at least punch him or her in the nose?
I am all ears. What would you do on a Tuesday?
It always happens because you and I get into the Louvre sometimes on a Tuesday. So you sometimes see this poor family that's there, you know, and they're told, oh, the Louvre is closed today. And they think, oh my God, I came all this way. I'm in front of the Louvre. What am I going to do? So what I told this one Spanish family one day who was just desperate, I said, you know what? About three blocks away, there's another little museum. It's called the Bibliothèque Nationale. It's the original National Library of Paris. It is just reopened, and in many ways, it's like a mini Louvre, and it's open today, and it's practically empty, and you can go for free in the big reading room, and your kids can read all of the comic books for free. And then if you want to go up the stairs up to the little museum, you can see more Greek vases than anywhere in France except for the Louvre. And you can go see, okay, you can't see paintings, but you can see the most incredible manuscripts of famous writers and artists. And when I said it the first time to this Spanish family, the wife of the family kissed me on both cheeks.
Oh,
she was so
beautiful.
Excited to be sent to another little museum. Oh, and there's a good cafe over there too.
What is that museum called?
It's the Bibliothèque Nationale Richelieu. It's the original National Library of France before they built the big, huge structure in the 13th arrondissement.
And then on your way out, can't you go down into the metro station, the Palais du Louvre, and see exhibits in cases
100%,
there?
100%. And that's free.
It's free and it's open all the time.
You go into the Louvre Rivoli metro station and you see the most extraordinary copies of sculptures and this great film, too. They do a great film and it's all free.
That's great. Hey, Elaine Chelino, you're full of great ideas, thanks to your love of Paris and in particular your love of the Palais du Louvre, the home of the great museum, the Louvre. Thanks for writing your book, Adventures in the Louvre, How to Fall in Love with the World's Greatest Museum.
Well, thanks for inspiring me, Rick.
All right. I'll see you in Paris, God willing, very soon.
Okay, great.
You can listen to Elaine's previous visits with us from our Travel with Rick Steves archives at ricksteves.com/radio. How to Breathe Life into Stone? Sculptor and stonemason Richard Rhodes explains next. Back in 1981, speaking broken Italian and with no experience, a young American named Richard Rhodes somehow convinced an old Italian stonemason to accept him as an apprentice with an ancient guild. The Freemasons Guild in Siena provided a direct but secretive link to Europe's greatest cathedrals and buildings, passing down techniques from master to apprentice for centuries. After 4 months of a grueling proving period, Richard made it. He became the first non-Italian to be formally initiated into that Freemasons Guild in its 700-year history. He learned their closely guarded secrets of turning stone into transcendent works of art. And he got in just in time because the guild system died out soon afterwards. Today, Richard is known as the last apprentice in stoneworking circles. He's been working with stone and sculpting for the last 40 years and preserves the closely guarded sacred rules of medieval stonemasonry in his book called Stone, Ancient Craft to Modern Mastery. Richard Rhodes, thanks for being with us today on Travel with Rick Steves.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm so pleased to be here.
What a story you've got. And reading through your book, it is clearly a labor of love, a love of stonework and masonry. Now, to me, you're kind of evangelical about all of this. I mean, I'd imagine to you, the average tourist must seem clueless about the powers and the majesty of a stonework, and what a shame it is not to get turned on by that. Now, as travelers, what should we appreciate about the stonework behind the great buildings that we're going to get to admire on our trips?
It's a great question, and I think the beauty of it is we don't have to overthink it, because the experience of stonework is almost entirely somatic, right? You're walking down the cobblestone streets or you're walking up the worn stairs of the Louvre, and you feel the depression of centuries of foot traffic that people have made as we experience this. So as we travel in Europe, invariably, we're moved by what we feel in our body. And this is such a revelation. Often, you know, I remember how in the 80s, you know, everyone first going to Europe and they'd invite you over to see their slide. Come see my slides from Europe.
Yeah.
And what would they talk about most? You know, this somatic experience of the cobblestone streets or the worn stairs, or I ran my hand on the railing.
Yes, yes.
And the dip of it, you know, because...
What is somatic?
Somatic is the feeling in the body.
There
right?
you go. Yeah, the somatic. Do you know the pavimento veneziano, the Venetian pavement? And it's a linoleum that's made with stone, and it's an ancient thing, and it's designed to flex as the foundations settle. And I like to stand barefoot on the pavement veneziano, and I'm just grounded in that history. And I like stone because you can touch it. I mean, when you think about artifacts, you're not supposed to touch things, but you can touch stone.
You can touch it, and it gets better when we touch it, right?
I love it. So that's it. This is a sensuous kind of appreciation of history.
Exactly. And I think that somehow that tactile connection to the past... You know, stone also is a sort of perfect medium, because it wears and weathers and becomes something better through its interaction with man.
But that's an interesting thing, because now we almost tear things down if it wears and weathers. But wearing and weathering, it's a glue to who we are.
Exactly, and it offers this very intimate connection. I make a distinction in the book between rock, which is as the material appears in the landscape, and then rock becomes stone once we craft it through the hand of man or through the wear of man, right? So
that's interesting.
So we're talking about stone.
I've been confused about that. So because I was going to say rocks, but there's a difference. So stone is worked.
Stone is worked or worn.
Or worn, yeah.
Yeah, so what's fascinating about it is it gets better, right?
So
it records
They put rocks on the Appian Way, and then later it becomes stonework.
Well, interestingly, so as soon as you quarry it, it becomes stone because you've already worked it in the extraction, right?
Okay.
And then the Roman roads are fascinating because they actually shaped them into hexagons, into polygonal shapes, but they tapered the bottom of each stone like a pencil. So imagine that as you drove on it or marched on it, it continued to seed itself into the landscape, which is why William Manchester, in writing about the roads of Europe in the 1500s, said that the Roman roads were still, after 1,000 or 1,500 years, were still the best roads in Europe because of that seeding technique. So the geometry of the polygonal shape of the Appian Way locks it in place, but the point on the bottom drives it into the substrate. And through use, the road got better and better and stronger and stronger and stronger.
I've always marveled at how resilient Roman roads have been, because you encounter them all over Europe, it seems. My feeling of cobblestone is... If you're a revolutionary, you can pick up one of those stones and throw it, you know.
Very useful.
Very useful.
Very useful revolution.
But with Romans, it's got that pencil bottom and it...
Pencil shape on the bottom.
It's anchored into the...
And the interlocking geometry, which fights the spreading forces,
Whoa.
Right? So the dispersing spreading forces is one of the great things to be solved in stonemasonry. So we're always strategizing about how to deal with those forces in a building, but particularly in pavements.
Yeah.
And because the spreading forces, you know, things want to drift apart.
Yeah.
So in cities, you know, those beautiful piazzas are lined by buildings, and that contains the spreading forces. But the Romans had this strategic method of how to keep the road together through the interlocking geometry and this point that continued to bed it, which is why those roads never drifted apart and never destroyed and are still travelable today. But that's stone, not rock, right? Because it's worked and improved by the hand of man, which is such a beautiful thing.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're exploring the timeless beauty of stone and how humans have used it throughout history with sculptor and stonemason Richard Rhodes. He's compiled the lessons he's learned from decades of sculpting stone in his book. It's called Stone, Ancient Craft to Modern Mastery. It includes the ancient masonry rules passed down through the centuries. Richard operates the Rhodes Work Design Studio in Seattle, and his website is rhodesworksdesign.com. That's spelled R-H-O-D-E-S. Now, Richard, I talked about these secret rules of ancient masonry, and for those of us who aren't stonemasons, it's all just it's confusing. Can you please just kind of straighten this up? Masons, masonry, Freemasons, Masonic Lodge, just in a moment, can you kind of, what is all that?
Yeah, that is a tangle.
Because Masonic Lodge, I don't think of guys with chisels. I think of hocus pocus behind the
right,
scenes
the hocus
with
pocus,
fraternities,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, so this is a fascinating story. Imagine that the Freemasons that were the first guild of Europe, and they were free men. So it really became a separate class of people for the first time, because you had the peasants, you had the royalty, and you had the church. And then suddenly you had this very small group of free men. They were the best and the brightest. Essentially, they had worked their way out of, you know, through either good deeds or through special obvious talent. Uh-huh. And they were the master builders, right? So they came together and they created a lodge, and they were allowed to, you know, they could essentially police themselves.
Because
they had their own rules. You have to imagine that the secrets of the lodge, which is the basis of this, were the state secrets of the time. Now, these are very simple secrets, right? Like, the book just lays them out. There's like seven of them. So it's not so complex, except imagine if I'm a king and my masons can build a bridge over a 50-foot cavern, but your masons can only do a 20-foot cavern. Well, you've got to run an extra 25 miles to get your army around that
right.
thing. All of these infrastructural improvements, these were the state secrets of the time. And that's how they kept, you know, to keep the secret, we had the secret handshake, we had how did these masters recognize each other?
And this was all like defense in an age of feudalism,
yeah.
when you've got
yeah.
these petty little dukes and kings and so on, and you've got chaos in Europe, no central government, power vacuum, but you do have the universal language of educated people, which is Latin, and you got this rise of stoneworking talents with these people who can do it. And you'll find great Gothic churches and castles and so on being built all over Europe, sharing, comparing notes and having roving bands of architects and masons that can do that?
That's
Is that
right.
from that environment?
That's exactly right. And so that's the beginning of the guild. And so this was so successful that as other trades started to emerge, they wanted to be part of the guild too. So what happens is, particularly in Venice, they finally broke apart. They were like, we actually don't want to hang out with the Freemasons because all they want to talk about is geometry. And you know, and it's really boring. And we're now doing international trade and international bankers. So it's sort of the ultimate boys club. So they split off from the Freemasons Guild. Then you had the operative branch of the Freemasons, which are the people that do the geometry and the stone carving and build these things, which is the group that I studied with. And this other group, the kind of mystical political organization.
Oh, so that's the schism there.
That's
where you have
the schism.
Masonic lodges and workers' union.
That's right. And so that mystical political union comes to the United States. It's very, very popular. Every president was a Mason until, yeah. you know, modern times.
It has nothing to do with stoneworking, and,
well,
masonry.
It did, right?
It so, did,
which is
yeah.
why they still have the symbols
yeah, right,
and the,
right.
you know, the tools of the Masonic Lodge, because it was... Originally, they were the operative
branch. The secrets had nothing to do with being able to build great stuff that they passed
Well, the
down.
Original secrets, the secrets
yeah.
that I reveal in this book,
okay.
which are really, you know, about how to do stone, right? And it was originally like trade secrets, right?
Okay,
like,
without getting into all the legalities of this, can you just tell me what these things are?
Well, a simple one.
Yeah.
It has to do with the grain of stone. Now, your listeners may not realize that stone, like wood, has a grain that's fundamental to its use.
In your book, I saw these horizontal grains in sandstone, I think.
Yeah.
And they're all stacked smartly because if they did it the other way, it would fall apart.
Well, right. So stone turns out to be like a deck of cards. And if you set it perpendicular to the force, you can stack miles high. If you turn it on its edge, then it delaminates.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was one of the main secrets.
What a terrible thing. If you got a building and it starts to dilapidate,
oh, I know.
You better call your mason and say, you got to move all these stones 90 degrees.
And there are cathedrals that were...
Delaminating cathedrals?
Delaminating cathedrals.
Oh. Yes. Okay, that's one of the sacred laws. This is cool. What's another one?
Another one would be...
Just real simple ones.
So one of my favorites, which has to do with aesthetics, is build it sweet to the eye. Which sounds simple, right? But what this means is, in modern vernacular, we would say, you know, if it looks wrong, even though you put your level on it, if it looks wrong, it's wrong.
Sweet
to the eye. So this is important because if you look at the Parthenon bows 20 inches to counteract the visual sagging that we see. It's one of the most sophisticated buildings human beings have ever built.
Yeah.
So
but
there's
it's
a
not
20
straight.
Inch.
It's bent
not straight.
In order to look straight.
In order to look straight.
That's like radical.
It's so radical and so exciting.
Richard Rhodes is a master stonemason with a studio in Seattle. And just down the road, the Tacoma Art Museum is among the places where you can view his work. Richard's written the book Stone, Ancient Practice to Modern Mastery, to celebrate the marvel that masterful stonework can be around the world. His book includes evocative photographs he's taken to view great works in person all around the world. His website is rhodesworksdesign.com, R-H-O-D-E-S.
So when you say, in your book you write, if one danger of the secrets is that they might be revealed, in this case, a sad but greater danger is that they might be forgotten and lost. The real thing is, let's appreciate these ancient bits of wisdom because they apply today, even though they seem counterintuitive today, where they might not have seemed so counterintuitive before.
They absolutely apply today. And this is part of the mission. You know, as I was joking with you, no one pays you to write a book when you're a stonemason or a stone sculptor. I wrote this book because I feel an urgency to preserve this empirical knowledge. I didn't show up to be the last apprentice. I've become the last apprentice.
Yeah.
Because the guild collapsed. And then I always assumed that I would have apprentices, but the world has changed. And, you know, people aren't necessarily interested in working that hard.
You can get it in a big box cheaper down the street at the big box store, this kind of mass-produced sort of art.
Exactly.
There's certain stuff that looks beautiful that nobody will see, and it's for God's eyes only.
Isn't that incredible? And I have to say, the masons that I worked with were all about that. Because you're doing it, if not God as an external, the God within you.
Yeah.
You know, you're doing it
for the love of beauty.
For the love of beauty. And so, you know, as an apprentice, I worked on pieces that, you know, I put my heart and soul into them and have them buried into the wall in the back corner.
Nobody would see it.
Because I was an apprentice. No one's, you're not going to put that piece in front. But it didn't matter, and it was so rich and so soul-satisfying, which is something that, you know, I think is a lesson for today when a lot of
it's all very practical, very cut corners, save money, save time, be on target.
And we wonder why we're kind of alienated and a little bit of isolated.
You know, I'll never forget climbing to the top of the Milan Cathedral. You've probably been there, Duomo,
a
beautiful flamboyant Gothic. And we're walking on staircases and walkways that were made for the workers, not for the public.
Yeah.
And you look at this incredibly ornate Gothic. It's the last flowering of Gothic, so it's over-the-top decorative, you know. And you see beautiful details behind what people can see from the street. And you think, nobody's going to see this except for the odd worker that goes up here. And I asked my guide, why? It's for God's eyes only, you know. And that is so beautiful.
I'm glad you mentioned the Milan Cathedral because I think it's one of those really accessible sites. You know, there aren't huge lines and you can get up to the roof. And when you're on the roof, of course, you see the gargoyles and you start to think, well, why did they carve these animal spouts, you know, to... but we've got to throw water off the building. Like, it's a big problem in masonry. You know, water is danger. It undermines the foundations and so the gargoyles launch the water, right? And then so they're these beautiful sort of animals.
Storm drains.
They're storm drains taking vast amounts of water and shooting it away from the building. So that's a great example of design arising out of the requirement of the program,
right?
And so much today we decorate things, we apply design rather than letting the design spring naturally out of the requirements of the program, which is a really important thing that I learned in the Guild and I discuss at length in the book. But the gargoyles at the top of the Milan Cathedral are a great example, and you can get right up close to them, and there's not a big line, and I highly recommend it.
Of course, the gargoyles scared away evil spirits.
Well, that helps too, right?
That helps. And a third thing that it does that I read in your book was they cut the wind, or they divide the wind.
They do, yeah.
Which I never even considered that, but that would be a practical thing, at least that you're...
Yeah, like stones in a stream, right?
Yeah.
So if the water or the wind is too fast, we break it up on a building by having projections so that, you know, especially imagine the scale of that building, right?
Et exultabit spiritus meus in Deo salutari meo.
Richard Rhodes illustrates and documents the mastery of stonework around the world in his photo book, Stone, published by Princeton Architectural Press. He's also known for his private and public art commissions. Richard has also started a fellowship chair at the University of Washington School of Engineering. His website is rhodesworksdesign.com. Richard tells us what his travels over the years have taught him about great stonework. That's in just a minute on Travel with Rick Steves. Richard Rhodes is telling us how he loves stone as a medium for great art and architecture right now on Travel with Rick Steves. After being trained for more than 40 years by the Stoneworkers Guild in Siena, as the only non-Italian to ever be invited to learn the secrets of medieval stone masters, Richard is known today in stoneworking circles as the Last Apprentice. He's written an impressive photo book called Stone, Ancient Craft to Modern Mastery, to help document the power of great stonework around the world and the lessons of the craft for future generations. Richard, looking through your books, I was impressed by the photographs and the coverage because you went and reported on and were inspired by locations in nearly 30 countries, and you photographed them personally and brought them home. And what struck me was these are universal truths. I'm used to thinking, oh, this is how you did it in Spain, or this is how you did it in the Middle East. But for this stonemasonry, it's global, and there are universal truths, universal beauties. It's not only universal in its breadth, but it's universal in its timelessness. This is a fascinating thing. If you just collected all of the art you put to illustrate your points in here, it's from every age and every continent.
I really appreciate you noticing that, and I think that was one of the big surprises for me as well. As my practice took off and I had commissions around the world, I would always take time to explore the local stonework. And as you said, 29 countries. And what I was thrilled to discover was that they are absolutely universal. And you have disconnected, disparate societies coming to the same conclusions, not only in what worked in stone, but what were the tools that were successful in shaping and carving them. So the first chapter of my book, I sort of go through how, as tooling changed, the expression of the stonework changed, how these kind of tooling breakthroughs. And we have to imagine 5,000 years ago, stone was carved, you know, the Egyptians started by carving it with hammer stones, meaning you take a stone that's hard, like a, you know, a river cobble maybe, and you bang it against the granite until you wear it down and you build an obelisk, right? So that's like 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. And then the Incas, 500 years ago, are doing the same thing.
And they didn't have guys going back and forth between some guilds.
There's no connection.
It was isolated evolution.
Isolated evolution coming to the same conclusion. So the beautiful Peruvian Incan stonework that we see, that we know so well is also done with hammer stones. But I think that's the perfect example, right? Because they're 4,500 years apart and I'm coming to the same conclusion.
I'm looking at, it happened to be on page 181 of your book, and I'm looking at two pieces of marble or stone coming together, and they have a barbell-shaped gap, and it's filled by a metal. What kind of metal would that be?
So actually, so you're looking at a stone dovetail on the column base of a column in Egypt, so probably 4,000 years old, and they're using a dovetail joint. And they would have used either wood to put in there or stone, but they didn't have metal.
Oh, they didn't have metal, so that would be a wood thing, but it's a staple. It's kind of a staple. Now, of course, in ancient Rome, whenever you look at those columns that are made with a bunch of like checkers that stack up, they're connected with metal staples.
Metal crimps, yeah.
And in the Middle Ages, desperate people chiseled to get that out because that was what was really valuable.
They'd
melt it down. Yeah. But I was just in Venice a couple weeks ago, and I was fingering the beautiful stone banisters, and I noticed they had the same kind of staples. And it's a barbell shape cutout when you put it together between holding the two stones together. And my guide said, you put your metalwork in there, and then like a rivet, you would pound it on each of the barbell ends, and that would splay it out, and it would be just solid as could be.
Actually, I think he didn't quite have it right.
Okay.
Because ideally, the metal, when they used metal crimps, the Romans, they would then pour lead around.
Oh, that was the deal.
Yeah, because
they'd pour hot lead on it.
Hot lead. And the reason was that if you metal, iron will rust, and as it rusts, it expands, and it blows the stone apart through a process called rust jacking. So this is the same thing you see when you're driving in, say, New York, and the salt from the roads washes into the concrete bridges, and it blows the concrete bridges apart.
Huh.
You see everywhere as you travel.
So this is
to prevent rust jacking, they would pour lead around and encase it.
Rust jacking. I mean, I've been at this game for a long time. I've never even conceived of rust jacking. And that's how this kind of information that you've dedicated your teaching to, it empowers us all to really better understand these universal kind of dimensions of stonework and everything. All the way back to the Stone Age has been sitting on this foundation of stone. Richard Rhodes is the author of Stone, Ancient Craft to Modern Mastery. He gave a TED Talk about the lessons he's learned from sculpting stone by hand. We include a link to that in the notes for today's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Now, when I read through your book, to me, for you, stone cutting is a very philosophical thing. It's even spiritual. You're a stone sculptor, but you're slow, it's physical, it's solitaire. It's a process that you're immersed in. You almost fold your hands together before you enter into that zone. Tell me what it's like to be with a hammer and a chisel for you, and how that might be the same for an Egyptian or an ancient Roman or a Michelangelo.
Well, I think that it's true. It's almost feels like a sacrament in a funny way.
That's it.
And in fact, they use the Shinto religion. They use stonework as to teach novitiates, because there's a kind of a release that has to happen. You have to kind of take the busy mind away and put yourself in a sense of flow to approach the work. So it does require kind of quiet. The other thing that happens, of course, is that the hammer and chisel are, you're totally connected. There's a sense of immediacy. And if you think of the real work of an artist, which is to grow this giant cable from your heart down your arms, through your hands, through the tools, into the material. So what you're doing is you're centering yourself, you're approaching this stone that's going to receive these blows and be shaped by it. And the energy of your being is kind of flowing down these fat, almost stereo cables in through the hammer, through the chisel, and what you feel is conveyed into the stone. And that's how sculpture is made. That's how this work is performed at the highest level. Now, when you're making, a stone, when you're learning as an apprentice and you're making, blocks for the column or the keystone or the voussoirs of an arch, it's not maybe that complicated. But when we're talking about decades and decades of practice, as you work your way towards mastery, that's at the highest level, which is, where I'm working now.
Right. And there's a dimension to that which is bigger than any individual person. I mean, throughout history, people have dedicated their lives to building something that would not be finished during their lifetime. And they've done it with abandon. They've loved it.
Yeah. And imagine that the cathedrals, right? These were multi-generational projects where a mason might spend their entire working lives on the foundation. You know, 20 years on the foundation for a cathedral. Something that no one would ever see. And the foundation, of course, is foundational, right? It's the most important part.
Yeah.
It has to be perfect. And it has to be woven together, has to be designed. It has to be assembled very carefully. You know, today we back up a concrete truck and pour a bunch of goop in the ground and it's, you know, we're on to the next thing. But this was very, very technical work that maybe no one would ever see.
And they appreciated the legacy of the dedicating a good part of their life to something that would provide a foundation that for generations and generations and generations would glorify God or give people a chance to come together
That's
or whatever
exactly
the mission
right.
was.
That's exactly right. Something outside of yourself, right? Something bigger than we are, touching the universal, the transcendent.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're speaking with Richard Rhodes. He's a sculptor, stonemason, author, and lecturer. He was also the first non-Italian apprentice in an ancient Freemasons guild in Siena. Richard reveals the rules of medieval stonemasonry in his book, Stone, Ancient Craft to Modern Mastery. We have links to Richard's work in the notes to this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio, and you can learn more about Richard at his website. It is rhodesworksdesign.com. You know, Richard, I think one thing that struck me as a reminder of how important this stone masonry is a guy that I think lived 5,000 years ago, Imhotep.
Oh yeah,
he was a stone worker, wasn't he?
He was the real deal.
if I was a stonemason, the last apprentice, man, Imhotep would be on my T-shirt.
Yeah,
tell me about Imhotep.
Well, we credit him as the very first master builder, and he's credited with the work at Saqqara, the original step pyramid.
The step pyramid. And he was like deified, wasn't he?
Absolutely.
I mean, let's just take a moment. This is a guy who built stone buildings and future generations worshipped him.
Absolutely. One of his amazing contributions was the stone column. And it's so incredulous to us as modern people to think that the stone column had to be invented. And they were so unsure of it that he kept it attached to the wall. They weren't sure of the strength of it. So he liked the visual repetition of a series of columns, but he attached them to the wall so they weren't freestanding.
The concept of a column was first decorative?
It first had to be invented.
Wow.
And when you look at these columns, you see that they actually look like bundles of reeds.
Yeah.
Because they made columns by bundling reeds together, so they trusted that. They knew what that was. So they made columns attached to the wall out of stone that looked like bundles of reeds.
Richard, this is so inspiring, and we could talk forever, but we're just about out of time. But I want to remind us that this is a travel show. And when people who are listening are traveling and they encounter great works of stone from the past, what would you recommend them to be mindful of to better appreciate what they're looking at? What should they be looking for? How can they better understand and appreciate the mastery of the masons that dedicated their lives to this?
Well, I think that the beauty of traveling in Europe is that it is fundamentally a stone culture. And we're not talking just the last 1,000 years, right? Europe was neolithically a stone culture. And there's more than 50,000 vertical stones that have been raised up called menhirs that are just in northern Europe alone. 50,000. That's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. And you just drive by these things without hardly noticing. There's just there's just something odd with a stone across the way.
Just a 25-ton stone that's standing vertically, put up by primitive people. Like, what is going on here? So these are really, you know, I think the best encounters as a traveler, heard you say many times on your show, happen down that lane that you didn't think you'd find anything,
right.
And there is something extraordinary because we have thousands and thousands and thousands of years of man manipulating stones for his use and for his purpose and for his, you know, even religious.
And it's not just accidental. That place is carefully picked. And the stone was not just laying next to it. The stone may have been moved 100 miles
to be there. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. The other thing that's extraordinary to think about is that, you know, there was a 200-year period between 1150 and 1350 where in France alone, they erected 80 cathedrals, 500 major churches, and tens of thousands of parish churches, all in stone. So the idea that we need to go, you know, certainly we want to see Chartres, we want to go see these masterpieces, yeah. Notre Dame, of course, but anywhere you go,
you'll find these things, yeah.
You find these things, and this was more stone than the Egyptians were able to place and quarry in 9,000 years of their civilization. And remember, the Great Pyramid alone, the largest single stone object in the entire world, is 40 million cubic feet. So the Egyptians were not shy about using a lot of stone, but just in this 200-year period in France, there was more stone than was ever produced.
For me, just the thought of a rockery in my yard is overwhelming. It's all those heavy stones, you know. And when I think about what has been built in Europe, on the front of the Rouen Cathedral, I think it is, or one of the cathedrals, they have a sound and light show, and they project, and it's colorful, and it shows all of the dimensions of the workforce that dedicated generations to building this church. Mm. And you just think how this consumed the society for some greater purpose than their immediate needs. You know, it just opens the door to all sorts of fascinating dimensions of culture. Richard, you use the term expressive stonework a lot, and you lament its disappearance from modern buildings. What do you mean by expressive stonework, and why does that matter today?
Yeah, so stone is capable as a material. It's capable of so much visual expression. Like every texture that you apply with a chisel or a stone, you know, or an axe, gives that, you know, the stone receives that texture and changes the light, changes how it feels. So it can look like corduroy, it can look like, you know, a rough, nubby wool, it can look jagged and split-faced. I mean, it has such an expressive range. And, you know, for thousands of years, masons have been very, very thoughtful about, if we do this, it'll cast a shadow. If we make a little gap, we can repeat this texture over and over, and there's rhythms, and you can read it like music.
There's a reason for all of this stuff.
It's all been thought through, and a lot of it, you know, it's remarkably beautiful. So what the book allows you to do is it gives you some basic tools so that wherever you're traveling, you can kind of decode the landscape you're seeing, the stone landscape, and understand, oh, why was it done? How is it done? What does it mean? And how does it feel? It's like learning to read music.
And it heightens our appreciation of the sophistication of that age, which we're very likely to underappreciate. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Richard Rhodes. His book is called Stone, Ancient Craft to Modern Mastery. Richard, you dedicate the last chapters of your book to something called your manifesto. Can you just tell us very briefly, what's the takeaway?
Yes, you know, I laugh because there really hasn't been a manifesto in architecture since Corbusier, and I was really sure that my publisher, which is Princeton Architectural Press, I was really sure that that was going to be the first thing to hit the cutting room floor. And they were very pleased to publish it. And I think the reason is that I've looked hard at the last 5,000 years. I've drawn these conclusions. I end up carrying these secrets as the last apprentice. And I explain them so that they're not lost, and I put them down. And then I weigh in the manifesto, I weigh in on how we need to think about stone going forward. Because actually, stone has really changed. We're not building structural stone buildings anymore. We're building with veneers. Now, the Romans built with veneers, right? You take a cheap material, you apply a beautiful material to the face of it. In Rome, they would kind of take rubble and put beautiful marbles. We build in wood or steel, and then we apply an expensive facade to it. And so these fundamentally change the way stone has been used because we're using these modern materials and methods. But we really need to reconsider it. Like, what's really important from the past, and how do we integrate that going forward?
You wrote, if the soul is not served, the architecture has failed.
Mm.
Is that part of the manifesto?
It is, yeah. I think it's...
It's pretty powerful.
I think, you know, the
setting
days...
setting a high bar.
It's setting a high bar. But remember that, you know, unfortunately in the United States, the average building life is 20 years,
and then
it goes to the landfill.
Yeah.
So we need to be thinking about buildings the way maybe they were thought of in medieval Europe, to build for future generations, to build things. Because you might say, oh, well, it's expensive to build a quality building. Yes, it's expensive. And mm-hmm. the use cycle, the use cost spread over hundreds of years is de minimis.
Yeah.
Right? So you take your time, you go slow, you be more thoughtful, you build something exceptionally beautiful, you serve the soul, and perhaps future generations can enjoy it the way we are enjoying our travels to Europe.
Amen. Richard Rhodes, thank you so much, and best wishes in your teaching and your travels.
Thank you.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. And we'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
Hey, I'm Rick Steves. Thanks for listening. In our online travel store, you can choose from 80 different Rick Steves guidebooks covering just about every country, region, and major city in Europe, as well as books on history, art, Italian food, cruising, and festivals, plus phrase books and planning maps. You'll find my favorite bag, the one I designed and I live out of for 100 days a year, and a selection of other custom-designed bags, backpacks and wheeled bags big and small, plus a selection of accessories that experienced travelers won't leave home without. It's all at ricksteves.com.